Accession number 6374, rule number 4.
Mr. Maguire, rule 4.
When I got back to camp again, I reported to the guardroom and they told me to go back to my own place. Next day, my leg started to swell about the size of a small melon. I went across to see our own doctor. He was a captain in the medical service, British medical service. He had come down originally from Harbin to Peking, to Shanghai, then to Singapore, where he was captured like we were. His name was Captain Konstantinovich Petrovsky. He is now in New Zealand as a consultant in Tasmania. He made me lie on the table. He got his scalpel and opened up my large swelling with no anesthetics. There were Japanese there, and at the sight of blood, it affects them very badly. They either go berserk or else there's a great deal of ooing and aahing. When they saw that, they gave me a packet of cigarettes each. Later on, I went back to my own place. 2 days later, I had to go back again to see the doctor. And this time, no anesthetic, took a needle and surgical thread and sewed up the wound. More Japanese, ooing and aahing, and more cigarettes.
Did the leg heal up?
Eventually, yes, eventually. I didn't go back to work for about a week. Then I was back again.
But do you still suffer from the leg injury?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. I walk with a stick. I got two, yes.
But you eventually had to go back to work in the coal mine, did you?
Oh, yes, yes.
How was the work supervised? Was it supervised reasonably or brutally or what?
It was reasonably. It depended on who was in charge. Again, it was the well-known Japanese word, speedo, speedo. Didn't matter if anyone got hurt, as long as you got your quota out.
Was it just British POWs working in the mine?
No. In another part of the mine, there were Koreans and Chinese and Australians who had been captured along with us. We were told not to contact them. It was quite easy to contact them, which we did. And they passed information that they had gleaned from elsewhere to us, and we did the same for them.
What type of information?
What was happening in the outside world, how the war was going. We knew how the war was going. we could tell what was going to happen, because when we were going down the mine, we had been warned, if you see a tall Japanese person shouting and swearing and cursing Japanese, pay no attention to him, don't talk to him. This person was an electrical engineer in San Francisco or Los Angeles, but across in the States. He'd come to visit Japan to honor his ancestors. When he was there, the Japanese said, stay where you are, you're not going back. And he hated this. Well, he used to give us the latest information. Now, and he used to pass us the Japanese vernacular papers. And some of us carried sticks to help us, but inside the sticks we could unscrew the top and put the papers in. That gave the Japanese version of how things were going from their point of view. Now, to get back to Konstantinovich Petrovsky again, he could speak, read and write English, Mandarin, and Japanese. We gave him the paper. And the Japanese were most amused. They thought he was reading upside down, but he wasn't. He could read there, and we got, the Japanese used to give us the Japan Times, which was published in English. And you could get it in Singapore, Shanghai, in Japan. And if you read between the lines, you found out that it sunk the US Navy fleet. The same ships. It sunk them every week. The Yorktown had been destroyed. It was still going strong. The Lexington, which eventually was sunk, it was still going strong. And we knew that the Japanese had been defeated in Manila.
So the Japanese from America used to shout and swear as a kind of cover to help you.
That's right, yes. Used to say, don't talk to me.
So did you ever receive Red Cross parcels whilst you were in the hands of the Japanese?
There were many, many Red Cross parcels that had been sent in. We knew that. And we demanded it. And they said, we haven't got any. And we said, we've seen them. Oh, well, when we're short of food, we'll give you them.
Was this in Japan or in...
That was in Japan. That was in Japan proper.
Did you ever get any?
Eventually, yes. Towards the end, when things were going bad, they said, right... Help yourselves, which we did.
Did you have any visits from the Red Cross or a protecting power?
Yes. The Red Cross came and went to see the Japanese camp commandant. And... He came round, he was allowed to come round, but we were not allowed to talk to him. He asked the questions, we would nod.
Did any good come from this visit?
No. He was just making sure that the Red Cross parcels had arrived, and he was showing them. There they were. And he said, "Why don't you distribute them?" They said, "Well, when we're short of food." Yes. And we were short of food. They kept cutting the rice ration down and down. But we had a visit. From one of the Kempi, that's the Kempitai, that's the thought police. And he said, "We want you to write." Now, he could speak good English. "We want you to write how good the Japanese people have been good to you." He said, "An officer, an NCO, and a private." So one officer did so, a private did so. I did so, and I, being a journalist, did all the writing. So they gave me large sheets of paper and a pencil, and I wrote. Now, I wrote with my tongue in my cheek, because I could do that, and said how wonderful the Japanese were to us, in particular the Japanese Navy, who rescued us. Well, that was all right. Now, they wanted to write some more, which I could do. Being a journalist, I could pad it out a great deal. And eventually, my story appeared, my report appeared in the Japanese papers, the Japan Times, in English, with my name on it. Now, the Japanese are funny people in the way. They said, "We shall pay you for this." Which they did. He gave me 100 yen. And because I was injured too, he said, "It was our fault. We shall pay you for that too." Which they did.
How much did the compensation did they pay?
Then 80 yen for the leg.
So you got 180 yen?
180 altogether, yeah. But you couldn't buy anything as such. You were not allowed to buy a pencil or paper. You could buy a sort of pepper to go on your rice. And that was it.
A sort of what?
A sort of a pepper. It was a reddish pepper.
Was this the only time when the Japanese attempted to get you to write anything for them?
Yes, that's the first time.
Did they attempt to get you to make broadcasts or anything like that?
They tried to, but we said no. They said, "Well, of course, your people would be able to hear." And we said, "No." I say, "Under the terms of the Geneva Convention, no." And they said, "The Geneva Convention is nothing. It's our law, Japanese law. We say what we want, not the Japanese Convention."
The Geneva Convention.
The Geneva Convention, yes.
Was this the only time you came across the Kempitai?
Yes, in Japan proper, yes.
Did you meet them outside Japan?
No.
How could you tell a Kenpitai from an ordinary Japanese soldier?
He had a cap badge. Different from the... He had a different type of cap with a badge on it. The Japanese soldier had a sort of fore and aft sort of cap.
Did you ever get bored whilst you were a POW?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
How did you keep yourself amused?
Well, in Thailand, I played bridge. Taught how to play bridge. And many good bridge players here. And whist.
How else did you keep yourself amused?
We, well, to get back to Changi again, we had a concert party. And there was exceptionally good performers. That was in Changi. We had one chap there, his name was Leo Britt. Sometimes we used to see him on telly in some play. And one of the pianists in Changi had played with Paul Whiteman in the States. And in the camp itself, in Japan, we put on a Christmas show. And it went down very well. And for that, we got a Christmas pudding from the Japanese. Made of rice, but it was very nice. And they gave us some sake. This gentleman called Wingy, he announced, "I shall play you, for you, the March of the Victorious Southern Army on the mouth organ." Well, he played it. So we gave him, he played it very well. So we gave him enormous applause. So he played it again. More applause. And he played it again. And again. And again. I thought, oh God, when's it going to end? So at last, it stopped. And we all had our photographs taken. Well, there was I've got them somewhere. A photograph of the actual cast, me and the others, and Japanese camp commandant in the photograph.
You mentioned that there were Dutch and Australian POWs. How did they get on with the British?
The Australians, yes. Japanese, the Dutch, no.
What was the problem with the Dutch?
The Dutch kept themselves to themselves.
Was there ever any animosity between British and Dutch?
Oh, no. The Dutch, having been a conquered race, they were just like us. There wasn't any real animosity.
Now, you were at Ube, I think, when
the bomb fell.
Can you tell me whether you knew that a bomb had fallen, whether it had any effect on you there?
The camp at Ube is roughly 40 miles from Hiroshima, where the first atom bomb was dropped. We were down the mine at the time, and we heard the noise like an earthquake. Well, Japan is prone to earthquakes, and also there was blasting going off down the mine, so we paid no attention to that. Then the Japanese foreman said, "All finish, go upstairs," which we did.
Was the explosion of the bomb as it was felt down the mine any different from an earthquake or from blasting?
Oh yes, it was, yes. It was one loud blast, and we could tell it wasn't just the blasting in the mine.
In what way?
Just a heavy noise.
Was it a louder noise?
A louder, even though it was quite a distance away, we could hear it. So when we came out of the mine, we were taken back to camp under escort. We could see in the distance, even that distance, the mushroom cloud.
What did it look like?
It just looks like what you see, just like a mushroom way up in the air.
Did the Japanese, did it attract a lot of attention from the Japanese?
Yes, it did. They were going about weeping, as Japanese are fond of doing. And we said, what had the matter? They said, "These hated Americans have dropped a bomb on our great city and killed thousands upon thousands of people." So we said, "We are sorry to hear that. So go back to your rooms."
Were you really sorry?
No. We had to pretend that we were. Because after all, death is death, no matter where.
Did you feel in any danger because of this bomb having been dropped?
No. We knew that a bomb had been dropped, and that was the end in sight. Then, of course, the Japanese came and told us what had happened, that a bomb had been dropped and destroyed the city, except for one particular building. Then they came along, and we heard afterwards that, of course, the bomb had dropped on Nagasaki and destroyed most of it except the Roman Catholic Cathedral there. Now, you may wonder, Japanese being Shintoists, there are many, many of them who are Roman Catholics and Protestants.
But did you feel that the Japanese might attack you because of what the Allies had done at Hiroshima?
No.
So they never threatened you because of it?
No, not at all.
What happened to you next then? Did you actually go and see Hiroshima?
Oh, no. The Japanese came and said, through their interpreter, "Things are very bad now." So we said, "What is happening now?" They said, "Take your Red Cross parcels and have a happy time," which we did. But before then, the Americans had dropped on one of the main squares outside the camp, a huge parade ground. They dropped enough food and a million packets of chewing gum and boots and socks and you name it, they dropped it. So we got the Japanese and said, "Right, you guard that stuff." And it was a monumental pile of stuff that had been dropped, and he said, "Guard that, don't take a thing." And they guarded it and didn't touch it. So we said afterwards, "Help yourself."
How did you come to get out of Ube back to freedom?
Well, we were in the camp, and the Japanese came in and said, the war is over. The emperor is going to speak. Well, they had a tannoy system outside, and we could hear the Japanese emperor squeaking away and said, the war is over. So there was only one death in the camp itself. One of the soldiers, he couldn't stand it any longer. He committed suicide.
Was this after the surrender?
Before. A day before. If he'd only lived. So the Japanese gave us a coffin, and we had the Union Jack with us, which we'd hidden away, and we put it over the coffin, and they took it away to the crematorium.
So how did you get out of Ubud? Did somebody come to fetch you?
No. We all marched down to the railway station.
Who'd ordered you to do that?
Our own officers, who were in charge. And we hoisted the Union Jack above our camp and took the rifles off the Japanese guards and put them outside, and we took the rifles and said, if you come in, we'll shoot you. But they didn't come in, so we marched down to the railway station and got on board a hideous train which skirted Hiroshima.
What did you see of Hiroshima?
Oh, we didn't see it. We didn't see it. No, we had to go right round because of the fallout. So we went to a place called Wakayama, which is on the inland sea. And there we were processed by the Americans. When we arrived at Wakayama station, there were American troops there, mainly Negroes. Oh, God. They're about 10 feet tall and twice as ugly. And they said, they saw us, they said,